welcome to today's Talky Bit. And let's just get right into it. This is kind of a bookend exploration of a topic that we opened last week. So if you missed that one, you might want to take a few minutes and go back and catch the podcast, which you can find on our website at thetablewinnipeg.com or kind of wherever you find your podcasts. But last Sunday, we did a bit of poking around in the reasons why there's this phrase, becoming acquainted with grief, that we were exploring. And we did a bit of poking around in the reasons why becoming acquainted with grief can be decidedly unappealing. And then a bit later in the week, this previous week, I had a conversation with someone that has had what we might call basically a head-on collision with grief in the form of the abrupt and utterly unanticipated loss of their life partner at a very young age, a few years ago now. And this person, who is someone who is well-equipped and well-supported in their journey with loss, someone who has made what I would most simply describe as the best kinds of choices in dealing with that circumstance, still, these years later, finds themselves reeling from the impact of that experience. Grief, even when well done, is powerful stuff. And so that can be disconcerting, to say the least. And when I made a comment in that conversation about how our culture increasingly doesn't know what to do with grief, this person just sort of spontaneously responded with this resounding, like, yes. Like, there was just all this resonance in response to that. And again, like, this is someone who's been well-supported and who's made great process choices along the way. So I was reminded that when we talk about the importance of getting acquainted with grief, the value of choosing to do so and not just being forced to do so, we're talking about something that is often sort of hidden from view. It's not that it's not real, but it kind of gets tucked away somewhere, along with other things in our culture that might be thought of as distasteful or awkward or troublesome, something to be avoided rather than leaned into. And of course, that's not universal. Anytime I talk about our culture, I'm talking about it in this monolithic language, like our culture was one-dimensional, and of course it isn't. And there are all sorts of pockets in the prevailing norms where this would not be true, where grief would be something that's very much sort of alive and well and acquainted with. But it doesn't seem to be the norm, and that's what I wanted to make that observation relative to. And to add to all of that, we're talking about it in this setting in the context of the pursuit of happiness, which could feel like a bit of a bizarre choice, so maybe the path of a contrarian or somebody that's, you know, preoccupied with their negative emotions or something like that. But my hope is that this idea will become more believable as we go along, a more accessible notion. I think there are some other possibilities other than just that to begin a conversation about happiness by talking about grief, just to treat that as something that's a little bit untoward. At the end of our time together last week, I suggested that sitting and spending some time with grief might be the path to seeing reality in ways that can save us from some things that are not great. Things like being the prisoner of fear, that maybe spending some time becoming acquainted with grief can relieve us of the constant vigilance of keeping our own sadness or sadnesses a secret, the battle to sort of keep the full version or the true version of our stories tucked away in a place that no one else is allowed to know about. There's this bumper sticker idea, this, you know, pithy saying that I think behaves in our cultural setting sort of like a quote from Shakespeare that we didn't know was from Shakespeare. There's actually a remarkable number of these. For example, phrases like describing something as a wild goose chase or describing an item as having seen better days and wishing it good riddance. Those are all sayings that came into the English language from the works of Shakespeare. But they've become so common that we don't think about their source. We just use them. And sometimes when we think about their source and examine it, we learn new things about the language we're using. And remember, language is one of the most important tools we have for making and conveying meaning, for giving shape to what we believe. And so that's one of the reasons why sometimes I stop and pay attention to it as though it were its own thing of value. Because these are the tools we use when we're exploring what we believe. And when we're trying to convey that, or when we're trying to communicate about it to one another as part of that examination. This actually matters in terms of sorting out what we believe. Even though we often use language without thinking about it, pausing to pay attention to it can sometimes help us to see how our view of the world might be getting formed in ways that we don't want it to, or ways that aren't ultimately tilted toward healing or toward the nurturance of life. That might have seemed like a little bit of a squirrel, but I was going somewhere. So the saying that I was thinking of when I went into all of that is this saying, the truth will set you or make you free. And it's sort of part of our vernacular, right? At this point, it shows up in some interesting places if you go looking for it. It is carved into stone in the original headquarters building of the CIA, which I sort of saw immediately when I learned that little factoid. I'm like, this is an enduring irony. Perhaps. Anyway, more recently, perhaps also as a less enduring irony, it showed up as a tweet from Johnny Depp after the verdict was announced in his legal battle with Amber Heard. The original is credited to Jesus as part of the Gospel of John and those stories. It's part of an address that is recorded as some things Jesus said to a group of Jews that were followers of his. And in translation, it runs more closely along the lines of, you will know the truth, which is, I think, an important process idea. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So that's sort of the roots of the saying in terms of its English shape. And there's a common addendum to that saying that I've heard a few different forms of. First time I encountered this addendum was in the course of seeing a counselor a few decades ago. And he said, speaking to me about something in my own life that I really did need to take full ownership of, he said, the truth will set you free, but it'll almost always incarcerate you first. And I've recently heard someone else say that the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off, which is more or less the same thing, just diluted, right? It's the same idea. And in my own experience, I would say that both of those addendums definitely resonate. There's definitely some truth there. I would add that, in my experience at least, the incarceration or the pissed offness can last a while, and that believing that we're still on the path to freedom while we're experiencing that other sort of side of that coin can be pretty challenging. It can be pretty hard to stay the course. And we might find ourselves needing some support to keep that belief alive, you know? My hope would be, among other things, that these next few moments can maybe be a positive contributor to that process. Just a bit of an FYI before we keep going. Getting acquainted with grief is likely to be more of a relational drama than a relational comedy. There's likely to be some strong emotions involved because grief itself can have a lot of personality. If grief was a person, it would sometimes be one that we might walk away after meeting them muttering, you know, too much. But as with other characters that sometimes strike us as too much, staying the course in those circumstances, in those relationships, can often reveal that it's precisely the over-the-topness that makes it possible for us to see really important life-affirming truths that we might otherwise never get a glimpse of. Got to stay in there. So, what might we see if we choose to sit and get to know grief better? And how might that relate to our pursuit of happiness? So I want to try something here. Let's imagine grief for a few moments. Again, an invitation, not an obligation. But let's imagine grief as a someone rather than a something. If you grew up around religion, this should be easy. We do this with, this is what God language is. So I'm going to do that. For the next few moments. And I'm going to use the more embracing pronouns they and them for this personification. And the reason is that I want you to feel free to imagine grief personified however you wish, including grief's gender. I've decided that I want to get to know grief better. So I invite them out for coffee, or tea in my case, because coffee makes me vibrate. And we meet at a place where it's possible to hear one another without raising our voices, which feels important to this conversation to me. And I ask grief to tell me their story. And they do. And it kind of doesn't go the way that I expect, like right from the start, because they start out by naming precious things, that doesn't feel like a surprise. What feels like a surprise is that they start out by naming precious things in my life, not in theirs. And they name things like people that I love, hopes that I've harbored over the years, ways that I've imagined the world could have been, ways my own life could have been, were it not for the hurts and the disappointments that have been part of it, hard experiences that have intertwined themselves into the deepest, most feeling parts of me. And we haven't been together sitting in this setting for very long, but I'm already thinking that this might not have been such a great idea. And that the time might have been better spent, you know, running any number of errands that are parked on my to-do list waiting for my attention. Because at first, all I can hear is that I'm being reminded that these things have all gone away. Like, all I can hear in the early going of this conversation is loss. And it's like I've invited someone to sit with me and make me feel sad. Just to sit with me and remind me that what I've wished for, dreamt of, worked toward, cherished is gone. And it's gone in a moment. It's like it just kind of whooshed away. And it seems like my therapist might have been right, at least about the part where truth locks you up, because at this point in the story, it feels like I'm hearing, you know, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help me God. And it's not exactly freeing. But here is what I'm slowly, slowly learning. This is not the moment to look at my phone and exclaim, oh no, I forgot, I've got to pick, you know, someone or something up in 15 minutes, I have to get going. By the way, if you and I are ever out for tea and I do this, it most likely means that I've actually forgotten somewhere that I'm supposed to be, but feel free to call me out on the other possibility as well, because like I said, I'm learning this slowly. So instead, at least this time, I don't do that. I ignore the ghost vibrating in my pocket. Does this happen to anybody else? Your pocket vibrates when there's nothing in there? Okay, good. Nice to not be alone. So I ignore the ghost vibrating in my pocket. I don't reach for my phone. And instead, what I do is I reach for something else. I reach for my courage. I reach for my determination. I reach for my humility. I reach for my I need to not bail grab handle. And I swallow hard and I say to grief, can you tell me more about this? And at this point, my head and my heart are in open conflict. My head is saying you are doing the better thing, and my heart is like, run. That's what's going on in there. And I do the better thing in this case. And grief takes me up on it and keeps talking. And they start to say things again that I don't expect. Things like how the world is precious. And as these conversations sometimes go, they tell me a bit of their story. They tell me a bit about how deeply they have loved and how fully they have trusted. And they tell me that from their perspective, all those hopes meant something. They pointed to something. They pointed, grief says, to happiness as the pulse of the world, the thing that keeps it alive, the thing that keeps it going. And then, in another turn that I didn't see coming, they express some indignation. They express some ire, some irritation. And they ponder out loud how it is that we live in a time and a place where the prevailing norms have hidden the truth, that it's the willingness to get to know grief that unlocks the reality of things like wholeness or unity or growth and even things like happiness. Why is it, they ask me, that we seem to think that it's a good idea to turn away from exactly what will open into what we're longing for if we will just stay the course? And then they get kind of emotional themselves, which makes me twitchy, despite the fact that I'm also a deep feeler. And when I spend a little time with that, I realize that maybe that's an old concern, that if I start crying, it's going to get messy, and then I'm going to get teased for it. But grief does not back down. I've asked for it, I suppose, and they're trusting me with it. And through their own tears, which somehow, in that moment, seem different than mine, maybe because they don't seem uncomfortable with them, they tell me that they're not weeping because grief means nothing, but because it means a great deal. They're weeping because tears, if we let them, can serve as a reminder of the world we sense could be, the world we should be trying to create for our kids and for our fellow human beings. And as I watch and listen, it occurs to me that their tears are washing clean a path for beauty, that they are rinsing away the detritus of a culture that has lost its ability to be aware of an essential truth. Sadness, grief says, sings the same song that joy does. The notion that those who mourn are blessed starts to come into focus for me. I've always thought that saying wasn't just difficult, it was either an enigma beyond my capacity to grasp, or it was absurdity, or it needed a cultural context that I couldn't access, or it was just some kind of runaway wishful thinking. But as grief tells me their story, I start to see the brokenhearted a bit differently. And instead of seeing them, or me, when I feel that way, as victims of tragic circumstance, I begin to see them as those who are unwilling to accept the sadness of the world with equanimity. Their indignation points to a wisdom that believes the deeper truth about the world is that it's meant to be good, to be whole, to be full of joy, and that although that is something we rarely touch, that vision is worth fighting for. They are the ones that see the full value of what has been lost and refuse to forget it. That same therapist that told me that the truth would incarcerate me before it freed me also had a quote from a Bruce Coburn song on their desk. I realize this might be a rather dated pop culture reference, but I'm hoping that the fact that the song keeps getting covered by other artists is going to save my butt. The tune is called Lovers in a Dangerous Time, and if you Google it, the Google verse will tell you that it is, in fact, a Bare Naked Ladies song, but it is not. They have recorded a great cover of it, though, complete with a music video that was so Winnipeg that it just made me laugh out loud. I don't know if they actually shot it here, but it sure looked and felt like they did, and if they didn't do it geographically here, they did it culturally here. It's hilarious. Anyway, I want to read us the lyrics from the song, because I think it does a really amazing job of talking about this intertwining of joy and sadness, and in a literal song actually sings about both of those things at the same time. Don't the hours grow shorter as the days go by? We never get to stop and open our eyes. One minute you're waiting for the sky to fall, next you're dazzled by the beauty of it all. Lovers in a dangerous time. These fragile bodies of touch and taste, this fragrant skin, this hair like lace, spirits open to thrust of grace, never a breath you can afford to waste. Lovers in a dangerous time. When your lover's in a dangerous time, sometimes you're made to feel as if your love's a crime. Nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight. You gotta kick at the darkness till it bleeds daylight. Lovers in a dangerous time. Does that add a dimension to what I mean when I say that joy and sadness sing the same song? And if it doesn't, I would actually suggest watching the music video, which I think does a pretty brilliant job of gesturing toward that idea of the cohabiting of joy and sadness. The quote the counselor had on their desk was just that couplet, "Nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight. You got to kick at the darkness till it bleeds daylight." Pretty decent fit with "The truth will set you free, but it'll incarcerate you first." That idea, though, that nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight, you got to kick at the darkness till it bleeds day and night, that idea is nonsense without a core belief that there's some daylight behind the darkness and that it's worth weeping because the sadness actually points to joy. Without that kind of given, that whole idea just falls apart. And that idea, that there's some daylight behind the darkness, that is not an easy idea to hold on to, especially when our heart is broken. It's the kind of idea that requires some reinforcement, that requires some other voices saying it in our ear when the going is most difficult. I won't get into it today, but I will get into it some point. There's fascinating new research about the ways in which we as humans come to hold and retain difficult or not common ideas. And at the heart of that research is this: that we actually can't usually do that without help. That we actually need those other voices in our ear, in our community. Now, this is not a formula for not being sad. It's okay to be sad sometimes, to weep when our heart is broken, and even to discover if we've been, you know, saving up our weeping for a while for whatever reasons, that it might mean that once we start, it does take a while to get it out. There might, if we haven't been weeping and we start, there might be a bit, and that's okay. All of us have lost something, and some of us have lost things so precious to us that, you know, we're barely hanging on. Some of us have suffered the kind of losses that have made us feel like there is no safe place in the world. And we're not sure, frankly, that we want to stick around. And these are great sorrows. And they should be wept over. And also, these losses, this sadness, this sorrow, it can bring healing. The great storyteller J.R.R. Tolkien once wrote, "I will not say do not weep. Not all tears are an evil." We need to not be afraid to weep and to sit with those that do. And here's something I'm learning is important to hear when I'm sad. I won't always be. That can be hard to believe when we're in the thick of it, right? It really can. Feel like if I crack this door open, the monster sadness is going to come in and it is going to eat up everything. It's going to just, if there's oxygen in the room, it's going to use it all. That's why we need those other voices, right? And joy, well, this is tricky. Learning to be less afraid of sadness is teaching me to be less afraid of joy. One would think this is not a fearsome thing. But joy is vulnerable, right? Joy is one, like maybe two breaths away from sadness. And sometimes, as I heard somebody say this past week, when you open your arms to joy, you get sucker punched. That happens too, right? But to return to a metaphor from last week, there remains the possibility that it's better to sail the sea of sorrow than to never let joy fill the sails of our boat. And so I would say, you know, sail on. We're going to leave it there. And we'll see where next week takes us in terms of this exploration. But I can tell you that that at least in terms of how we continue to explore, we'll continue to do it together. And to me, that feels like good news in the context, you know, wherever we go. And the reminder, if you're having trouble staying the course, that we continue to head toward happiness. All right. Peace, everybody.